right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday. Yes, Friday, January 5th, 2018. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, everyone. It is 2 degrees with light snow and a real feel of minus 23 here in upstate New York. They did cancel schools today. So where do we leave off yesterday? The show was titled Jim Duke and Leonard Ulrich, Blockchain and AI, Brain of the Beast. Now, I gotta say, I received a couple comments in regards to the fact that this guy was a little bit religious, and I really don't get off on Jesus talk, to be honest, but I thought he had a couple valid points. It was interesting that somebody looking at things through the lens of the Bible actually sees a lot of the things that we've been talking about on this show. And I'm not going to say this is all biblical stuff that's going on, but I got to tell you, when you look at the largeness of what is happening right now and the destructive potential of these disruptive technologies that are all rolling out at the very same time to turn our society on its head, you got to really sit back and think about what that means for the future and what the future is going to look like. I think I've illustrated pretty well where this is headed. So, I mean, honestly, after doing this show almost 6 years, I want to tell you guys, you know, when I run some sort of lecture or talk or interview, it has been, for the last 6 months or so, extremely difficult for me since I was in the hospital and all that stuff happened this summer. I've kept going just because of my sense of duty, but this has gotten to be a very large chore for me. You know, everybody was all excited that I didn't have any lasting effects, but one of the things that I've been noticing is that my natural ability that I always had to be able to multitask on a grand scale and juggle lots of balls to do lots of things all at the same time has been affected somewhat. And instead of it being painless, now it's become a little bit painful. And this is on a daily basis doing this show. I mean, it really, every morning it's been causing me some stress. So I don't know, 2018, I might decide to crank things back just a little bit. I don't know, I got to think about this a little bit, but I don't know if I'll be able to keep doing this 5 days a week here every single day for another year or two or three. We might have to crank it back a little bit. So anyway, back to yesterday, blockchain and AI, Brain of the Beast. I don't think he talked a lot about blockchain, but the reason why I found that interesting was because we had covered a paper the end of the show 2 days before titled Blockchain Thinking, the Brain as a Decentralized Autonomous Organization. And they had discussed how they were going to utilize the security and the trusted exchange between different peer-to-peer entities to enable large-scale distributed computing to become the basis of mind file uploads. And I could see this happening. Being able to upload us to the machine is something that they have been working on for a very long time. You know, remember there's all this longevity medicine, live forever type stuff, immortality projects going on. But they are also trying to digitize biology. And you go to places like the Weiss Institute of Biologically Inspired Engineering, and you will see that very plainly. They're trying to reverse engineer biology and then garner any secrets that they can by applying artificial intelligence and putting it all into a big database to correlate, splice, and dice, try and find some sort of meaning. Someday, promising you the dangling carrot cure. Well, as we have all these technologies moving forward, of course we have 5G. 5G that is going to interconnect the Internet of Things. We also found out that there is another flavor of blockchain out there that's called IOTA. And I didn't pull up any stories about that, but Camille dropped me something this morning, a new one about IOTA going into partnership with Microsoft. And maybe there was a Samsung in there. I don't quite remember. But it was a blockchain built specifically for the Internet of Things to be able to interchange sensor data, biometrics, any type of data that you want to protect. You know, remember those pesky HIPAA regulations that Obama talked about? Well, don't worry about that, because they've gotten around that with blockchain. But they have this interchange medium now with this IOTA blockchain that's going to allow all of the smart devices in your home to quietly and securely, wink, exchange information about you and send it up to the cloud. So, I was trying to figure out where to start today. I have some stuff that maybe isn't brand new, but it actually took me down a path with some newer stuff that came out just over the last few days. So here's a story out of Stratfor. I think I might have started this one the other day. This is just a few days ago, January 3rd, 2018. The promise and the threat of AI. High-level problem solving isn't for humans anymore. As computers gain speed and accomplish dazzling feats like defeating the world's masters at chess and go, and some of the planet's brightest minds warn that human beings may find ourselves obsolete. Further, a kind of artificial intelligence race may come to dominate geopolitics, rewarding the owners of the best AI mining, the biggest pools of big data, and most likely as a result of its sheer size, China. We've talked about that before. China's smart cities, like in Hangzhou, where they have analytics running and smart traffic patterns and predictive policing going on via the digital cameras and facial recognition and license plate readers and all the other things that we've talked about, running in a big data center and calling out police if needed. Or consider another dire consequence as AI-driven robots replace more and more workers, from truck drivers to insurance adjusters, loan officers, and any number of other white-collar occupations. Unemployment will rise. And we've also talked about radiologists and neurologists and oncologists and things of that nature. And one of the other things in looking at blockchain that the guy that was interviewed yesterday was talking about, that Leonard Ulrich, was that in, let's say, a real estate transaction, right now you have attorneys, you have real estate agents, you have notary publics, or verifying your identity. You also have, I don't remember what they're called, the people who search the title search companies. And everybody gets their piece of that financial pie. Well, with something like blockchain, especially if you put like real estate transactions online where everybody has their trusted persona and they've been verified and it can't easily be changed, the system itself is always verifying that there are no changes in the chain. So you'll be able to have trusted transactions with no middleman involved. Think about what that's going to do. How many people do you know, friends that do real estate on the side, or friends that maybe had a real estate law degree and kind of do it on the weekends through a bank or something to get some extra cash? Or have their own little business running out of the garage, out the back. You know, just think about that, guys. This is going to decimate whatever is left of middle America. Everything is going to go on, maybe not the chip, but in the cloud somewhere. So how will economies adjust? And should we imagine a utopia filled with gratifying leisure activities, or a feudal dystopia in which the wealthy elite hold the few precious jobs unsuitable for the computers? The stakes are high, but the terms of the debate run far, and they are confused. The recent advances in AI are impressive, but the future prospects for technology are truly amazing or frightening. Even so, between artificial intelligence and truly human intelligence lies a host of differences that much of the literature on the subject has failed to adequately address. In this column, I will try to sort fact from fiction. Thinking about thinking machines. So in a rich analogy of short essays, What to Think About Machines That Think, William Poundstone, author of Are You Smart Enough to Work at Google, begins with a quote from the computer science pioneer Edsger Dijkstra. I never heard of him. Quotes, the question of whether machines can think is about as relevant as the question is whether submarines can swim. Both a whale and a submarine make forward progress through the water, but they do it in fundamentally different ways. And likewise, both thinking and computation can come up with similar-looking results, but the way they do it is fundamentally different. On the other hand, Freeman Dyson, the acclaimed physicist at Princeton's Institute for Advanced Study, dismisses the question. His is the shortest of all essays in the anthology, edited by John Brockman, which irrelevant details. It reads in full, I do not believe the machines that think exist or that they are likely to exist in the foreseeable future. If I am wrong, as I often am, any thoughts I might have about the question are irrelevant. Spoken like a good physicist, I'd say. I had a lot of physicist friends in college. That's pretty funny. Before being quite so dismissive, though, let's take a deeper look at what the alarmists like Jules are saying. By the end of this short essay, after all, Poundstone comes along and, having opened with this Dijkstra's apt aphorism about submarines that don't swim, Poundstone cautions on a cautionary note, quote, I think the notion of Frankensteinian AI, and that is AI that turns on its creators, is worth taking seriously, unquote. And so do I. So the dangers of ultra-intelligence. The case for concern is nothing new. Way back in 1965, British mathematician Irving Good wrote, quote, let an ultra-intelligent machine be defined as a machine that can far surpass all the intellectual activities of any man, however clever. Since the design of a machine is one of these intellectual activities, an ultra-intelligent machine could design even better machines, and then there would be unquestionably an intelligence explosion. The intelligence of man would be far left behind. Thus, the first ultra-intelligent machine is the last invention that man need ever make. That sounds like a good sci-fi episode of something, provided that the machine is docile enough to tell us how to keep it under control. Yeah, like that is going to happen. We've already discovered with Google's deep mind that when they put adversarial networks against each other, and that would be two artificial intelligences competing in a virtual world for scarce resources, what happens is that the AIs begin to get violent and aggressive. So, you know, if you're the one that's got the red off button next to your knee under the desk, I don't think that they're going to be benevolent to us, unlike what Ben Goetzel is hoping for. The last provision is key. While the Sorcerer's Apprentice may not be as malevolent as Frankenstein's monster, even the best-intentioned apprentice can get out of hand. Yeah, look at every teenager. Hence the increasing attention of two different issues in the debates over AI. First, there's the question of how soon, if ever, machines will surpass human intelligence. Second is the debate over whether, if they do, they will be malignant or benign. In his book, Life 3.0, Being Human in the Age of Artificial Intelligence, Max Tegmark distinguishes five different stances toward AI based on these two dimensions. The categories come in handy for grouping many contributors to Brockman's volume, as well as to the many participants Tegmark pulled together for a conference on AI a few years ago. One, those who believe that AI will exceed human intelligence in a few years. Virtually nobody these days, says Tegmark. So don't worry about it, because it's not going to happen in the next 5 years. Number two is the so-called digital utopians who hold that AI will pass up human intelligence in the next 50 to 100 years and that the development will be a boon for humanity. And that would be like Kurzweil. Kevin Kelly belongs in this category along with the singularity is near author Ray Kurzweil. Ding. Number three, people who think that, on the contrary, the achievement of superintelligence by machines would be a bad thing, whatever it happens. Tegmark calls adherence to this idea Luddites, and I am proud to put myself into that category. The contingent includes Martin Rees, the Royal Society's former president, and the American Computer Society's Bill Joy, who wrote the famous cover story for Wired titled Why the Future Doesn't Need Us, and we have covered that a couple different times. Number four is a group between the Luddites and the Utopians called the Beneficial AI Movement, which contends that AI is likely to arrive sometime in the next 100 years and that we better get to work on making sure that its effects are benign, not malignant. And that would include Elon Musk, as well as Oxford philosopher Nick Bostrom, the author of Superintelligence, Paths, Dangers, and Strategies, as are most people who took part in the January 2015 conference, largely to launch the Beneficial AI Movement. And number six, I believe. Finally, there are techno-skeptics, as Tegmark calls them, who believe that AI will never rival human condition. And along with Dyson, Jaron Lanier, the inventor of virtual reality, belongs to this group, as does neuroanthropologist Terence Deacon. If you accept the taxonomy, then the major questions about AI are how soon it'll overtake human intelligence, whether that event will have beneficial or deleterious effects, and what we should do now to prepare for those effects. Sounds reasonable enough. But there is a problem with Tegmark's taxonomy. It assumes that AI is trying to overtake human intelligence on the same racetrack, as it were. And as with the whale and the submarine, however, computers and human minds achieve similar ends through vastly different means, though first glance they may appear to be doing the same thing, and that is calculating. Computers are built to be precise, enter a given input and you get the same output every time. The behavior is stream. Brains, on the other hand, are messy with lots of noise, and when computers are precise and deterministic, brains are stochastic, which I'm not exactly sure what that word means, but I'm thinking more of a chaotic format. And where computers work by algorithmic sequences, and we just found out that there was an algorithm that the brain works upon that simulate deterministic patterns of mechanistic cause and effect, the mind aims at meanings. So where computers run on hardware using software that is unambiguous, one-to-one mapping called code, the brain runs on wetware. And that is a term you're going to start seeing more and more that is going to differentiate between the meat bags, which are us, the tin cans, which are Atlas, and the skin jobs, which are going to be where, if we make it through all the stories today, we're going to end the show. Where computers run on hardware using software that is unambiguous, one-to-one mapping is called code. Brain runs on wetware that is just not a circuit diagram of neurons, but also a bath of blood, hormones, and neurotransmitters. One of the reasons why dopamine is so important, also oxytocin. So to be fair to those who buy into the computational metaphor for the mind, and all of the digital utopians do, AI might easily be confused with human intelligence because, however much we may know about AI, we know shockingly little about how the brain works and next to nothing about how subjective consciousness emerges from that bloody mess. But what we do know is that the brain is not a hardwired circuit board. Techno-skeptic Deacon's deconstruct Silicon Valley's adoption of the computational metaphor. In his book, Incomplete Nature, quote, like behaviorism before it, the strict adherence to a mechanistic analogy that was required to avoid blatant homuncular assumptions. I mean, talk about like pompous language here. Come at a cost of leaving no space for explaining the experience of consciousness or the sense of mental agency. So, like a secret reincarnation of behaviorism, cognitive scientists found themselves seriously discussing the likelihood that such mental experiences of consciousness do not actually contribute any explanatory power beyond the intermediate material activities of neurons. I don't know if that made any sense. But hey, let's jump to the next story because we already have wasted 20 minutes. So this one is titled China Reveals Major AI Center. And this was 2 days ago. The brand new $2 billion with a B dollar facility will be based in Beijing and focus on, quote unquote, national level use cases for AI. Beijing is going to get a huge AI research center in the city's west, according to Reuters. Citing the Chinese news agency Xinhua, Reuters says Beijing is looking to invest $2.12 billion to build the center in the city's Mentao district, which will house more than 400 different enterprises. It will have an annual output of 50 billion yuan, and the developer of the project is the Dong... I hate trying to say Chinese names. Dongguangkong Development Group, and the group will look for partners among foreign universities. The center is intended to be a national-level AI lab. Artificial intelligence is relatively new with huge application potential, which is why many of the world's leading economies are looking for ways to develop and improve the technology. China's goal is to become a world leader in AI by 2025. And Reuters also says the tensions are flying high between the United States and China when it comes to applying AI technology in the military. As a country, China is doing a lot to improve its AI game and is working on growing the local industry from 150 billion yuan in 2020 to 400 billion yuan by 2025 and is doing a lot to bolster talent and investing in AI by urging all companies, private and public, to cooperate. So AI is chugging along in the United States, and one of the big places where it is chugging along is in the healthcare marketplace. Now, we read about yesterday and the day before, actually it was more the day before, about all the different ways that blockchain is invading different vertical markets here in the United States. The government's getting on board, education, healthcare, different legal agencies to be able to secure transactions and to grow and to keep away pesky hackers. One of the things I was reading about, you know, everybody has been talking about the lack of security. Oh my God, the Internet of Things. We can't be safe from hackers. Well, maybe the blockchain will help us. Listen to this. We also have all those pesky HIPAA regulations. We have the Internet of Things. We have things such as neural dust and all of these remote monitoring applications, Dr. Watson smartphones that are coming to alleviate our crisis that we have in healthcare and be able to provide you 24/7 monitoring so they can determine whether or not you're getting ill before it even happens. Predictive healthcare. So this one caught my attention. IBM, blockchain and artificial intelligence combo to alter healthcare. And I saw IBM was getting into the game big, and I thought they were working with some of the Ethereum product that we covered the other day. The combination of blockchain and artificial intelligence has a potential to completely overhaul healthcare in just a few short years. This was November 2nd, 2017. Combination of blockchain and AI could bring significant improvements to a healthcare sector plagued by interoperability problems and big data analytics shortfalls, says IBM Watson Health Chief Scientist Officer. And speaking at the Fast Company Innovation Festival in October, he announced that the company would be expanding its exploration of healthcare blockchain opportunities with a new partnership with the CDC. And the CDC has already been engaged in blockchain pilots around public health responses and crisis situations and is looking to further its ability to define value-driven use cases for the technology. A new partnership will complement the existing collaborations between IBM Watson and the FDA, given IBM's additional insight into how blockchain, in tandem with artificial intelligence, could overhaul the way the stakeholders extract meaning from the overwhelming volumes of big data in the industry. Hold on 1 second, I got to pull my heater a little closer. Blockchain is very useful when there are so many actors in the system, and it enables an ecosystem of data and healthcare to have more fluidity, and it allows AI users to extract insight from the data. IBM has been angling to become a leader in the blockchain space with several projects in financial services, healthcare, and other sectors that could benefit from the distributed ledger approach to data management. Blockchain is a major focus for IBM as a whole. And the big investment for IBM, of course, is Watson Health, and it thinks blockchain could have a major impact on healthcare and life sciences, especially around how big data is stored, shared, and used for various applications. Blockchain purports to offer enhanced security and data integrity, as well as opportunities to maintain more control over access to their data and how it is controlled. Healthcare data resides in many different places: the primary healthcare provider, the hospital, the lab where the results are processed. And if you have a patient's consent to share the data between these different areas, you could pull together the different elements for use within a particular application or service that is needed. A permission blockchain brings together trusted collaborators, and each of them can join the chain or run their own chains. Make sure you check that box so you can join the guinea pig research. And the distributed ledger will keep track of all the events that are important for that particular iteration of the provider within the patient's care team for whatever they're trying to accomplish. Payers are also keenly interested in creating more trustworthy data management system, and that would be the insurance companies, as they could support better value-based care and complex administration processes involved in claims, education, and payment. Oh, I see you're eating Cheetos there, Johnny. That isn't going to jive well with being in the hospital last week. I mean, guys, this is going to become extremely invasive. We have this 24/7 monitoring. Remember, that's what that IOTA blockchain was about. Is providing real-time streaming from smart devices that are in your environment to the blockchain so they can interact. And blockchain is one of the emerging technologies that could allow payers to programmatically throttle payments or incentives based on external data sources. So like, hey, you're going to have to pay an extra $200 if you eat that ice cream. Instead of adjusting payments through laborious administrative processes, he explained, and as long as you can provide an attestation that a certain best practice is being followed, look, you did not comply with the terms, you can create credits and debits in the provider's virtual wallet to provide incentives. And that is a fundamental redesign of what value transfers look like today. Almost all the nation's large healthcare plans are currently implementing or actively planning to spin up a blockchain solution for at least some of their administrative needs, as a recent survey from BlackBook, setting up the potential for broader adoption in the near future. Activity in the insurance space is quickly outpacing interest in the provider side. 68% of all size insurance is aimed to take blockchain approach in at least one business problem by the end of 2018, while 12% of providers are planning to do the same. And think about it, also your car insurance, you're going to have little black box feeds for every single thing you do. Self-driving cars are going to watch everywhere you go. This isn't going to be a pretty future. And as with financial services and banking, the payer faces use cases for operational efficiencies, and the back-end processes may be clearer at the moment, leading to speedier adoption rates. Right, cut out all the middlemen, make more profit. Payers may also be able to use AI tools to identify fraud and incorrect billing and efficiently, and if blockchain-based provider identity management and claims education techniques make it easier to identify anomalies in billing patterns. Remember, you're also going to have an online digital ID. And however, adding a layer of artificial intelligence to this blockchain could also drastically improve healthcare providers so they can extract actionable insights from big data that is fundamentally more trustworthy than before. Yeah, like asking the patient questions. Did you take your pills every day? Oh, look, your smart pill says that you didn't. And if a patient himself has verified that his records are complete and up to date, and we find out later that you lied, because that is what's going to happen, and accurate on a permission blockchain, artificial intelligence algorithms that stratify risk, suggest diagnoses, or identify gaps in care may be more efficient and effective, for example. Now, how frightening is that? We're going to give you a risk number, Johnny, because you're doing things you're not supposed to do. A recent Frost and Sullivan report suggests that the convergence of blockchain with machine learning and AI could also reduce pharmaceutical supply chain issues and create better clinical trials and allow integration of the Internet of Things data into clinical care environments. The blockchain-based system will enable unprecedented collaboration, bolstering innovation in medical research and the execution of larger healthcare concepts such as precision medicine and population health management. You will be managed, and that is the way it is going to be. Every facet of your life will be managed, and it will have to be good for you to keep the social cost down. Blockchain technology may not be the panacea for the healthcare industry challenges, but it holds a potential to save billions of dollars by optimizing current workflows and disintermediating some of the high-cost gatekeepers. The confluence of blockchain and artificial intelligence is not too far away, and by 2025, Forrest and Sullivan expects that the healthcare industry will be deeply immersed in both the technologies across the payer, provider, and the pharmaceutical segments. IBM also believes the inflection point for AI and blockchain is just over the horizon. While the industry is still in its infancy at the moment, progress happens quickly and unforeseen breakthroughs can radically alter the technology experience in just a few short years. So when a bunch of physicists collaborated and created this thing called the World Wide Web a few decades ago, nobody imagined Facebook, Google, and Amazon. So with blockchain, we can collect data and extract insights through artificial intelligence, and the future will have an economy around that that we can hardly even imagine right now. Because remember, all of your data is going to be monetized, and that is what we discovered in reading about that IOTA blockchain. You will be sold, and there will be money to be made. Remember, a lot of these blockchains also have involved cryptocurrencies that are used for exchanging applications and data between the applications. People are making bazillions of dollars. And like I have told you, that is the dangling carrot. That is one of the seven deadly sins they used to talk about. One of those seven things that can corrupt man to go places they wouldn't normally go. But with this promise of this glowing light on the horizon, people are throwing their support behind these technologies. There is this promise. Yeah, but they don't see. There is also the threat of losing your autonomy completely. So I ran across something the other day. This was from October 17th, 2012, but it doesn't matter because it's out of Psychology Today. This is one of those articles that's kind of time-tested, titled Greed, the Ultimate Addiction. Now, we have talked about addictions before, that dopamine carrot button that is pushed very frequently utilizing our devices that is helping suck us into the machine. So what is the unquenchable thirst for wealth all about? And like I said, all of this crypto boom and just putting blockchain in your name, fueling 200% increases in your stock price is all about. So what connects the various elements of addiction is that enough is never enough. Not for long, anyway. And the addict, as the addict progresses, or rather regresses into their addiction, they derive sufficient gratification that they must constantly seek more and more of their drug of choice. And that is just like dopamine. So for more is the keyword of addiction, and it doesn't matter whether they are addicted to a substance, a relationship, or an activity. The ante for getting enough of the object of their craving must continually be raised. But of all the things that one might be addicted to, nothing tops the greed-laden pursuit of wealth in its audacity, manipulativeness, and gross insensitivity to the needs and feelings of others. Not to mention its extreme short-sighted, irresponsible covetousness. And remember, this is on the spectrum of psychopathy. We looked a lot at psychopathy in the past and how it is involved with this dopamine region of the brain and the lack of empathy. Ask a multimillionaire or billionaire so afflicted, and if you can find one willing to talk to you, and you will discover that their mega fortune quest really has no endpoint. They won't be able to name a definitive millionth or billionth that finally will do it for them, because they can't, which means that they will recap their riches as itself becomes an end. Chasing every financial opportunity, and it cannot be overemphasized, to the detriment of virtually everything else in their life. Ding, 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 ding. This is what the billionaires that run the planet do, has become their end-all and be-all. And for that, frankly, is where that dopamine is, the master molecule of pleasure and motivation. And the end for them is simply the high, or the dopamine release they receive each time they do a deal, turn a profit, or make a quote-unquote killing. And just like other addicts over time, because of the related phenomenon of tolerance and dependency, they need to make bigger and bigger killings to get the ego gratification they require in order to feel good about themselves. So this time they are playing for the ultimate game of world domination with the technological grid that they are dropping upon us at a cellular and even a molecular or a femotechnology level. In general, their money high has to do not just with the feelings of fiscal elation, but also with a kind of self-inoculation. What perpetual wealth production inoculates them against are underlying, barely recognized feelings of distress, such as depression, anxiety, guilt, or shame, which stems from a belief that deep, deep down, they may not be good enough at all. So greater and greater financial success is required to help them sustain their cherished illusion that they really are superior in economic terms, vastly superior to others, and most conveniently, ding, ding, a narcissistic fix for whatever subterranean doubts they may yet harbor about themselves. And this is the society that we are creating in the future, is this narcissistic, centralistic, instant gratification society, where you don't necessarily have to work for things anymore, because there will be a world of plenty in the future. And you can take advantage of data off of your fellow man and sell it to the machine, as you are selling out humanity to make bazillions of dollars. So it should be stressed that whatever appetite they may have for their quote-unquote things, their indeterminable lust for making money really doesn't have much to do with tangible purchases. Contrasted with spending addicts, which is a compulsion that drives such over-the-top consumers such as shopaholics into unimaginable debt, greed, or wealth addicts are hardly focused on depleting and dispersing their fortune, but on acquiring it and maintaining it, which is why this isn't going to work out well for us in the end. Unconsciously linking their fundamental human value to their financial worth is what drives their behavior to accumulating such wealth, and when they use it to acquire still more wealth, they feel as though they have been stripped of all their personal value when they give it away. And so it has been said that you never get enough of what you really want, and with people being addicted to pursuing wealth, their overwhelming, insatiable passion isn't about getting rich, but it's about getting richer and still richer. And it is unquestionable that this is not a virtuous cycle, but a markedly vicious one. And ultimately, their heart's desire, tragically unknown to them, isn't for wealth at all, but for love, emotional intimacy, unconditional acceptance, and self-acceptance, which they will never do, and rich, satisfying relationships, which they'll never get by being a tyrant. Regardless of how obscenely wealthy they may become, these are all things that, alas, cannot be purchased with money. That's why you need to just get back to simplicity. Get rid of all of the rat race. I lived in the rat race, where it was always that dangling carrot that was motivating me to the next day. And I got to tell you, that motivating carrot, in the end, when you look back at it all, especially when you're faced with your own mortality, something in this last year I've had to do again, which would be my third or fourth time in the last decade or so, really begin to look at what is important and what is not, and what it all means. And it is not about the rat race or chasing that dangling carrot, because in the end, you can't take it with you. And that's the sucky part. You can't take it with you. So anyway, the final debacle of their pursuit isn't simply that their monetary accomplishments can't bring them the everlasting happiness and peace of mind they secretly crave, unless, of course, you find a way to spend it, to upload yourself to the machine. And that's what a lot of them are doing. Remember, we talked about that, Silicon Valley executives trying to defy death. But it is that their futile quest generally causes all sorts of misfortunes to others, as well as making them guinea pigs and selling out humankind, as well as to our environment, which they blithely ignore, and to our nation, whose misregulated capitalistic system regrettably supports their ceaseless, avaricious ventures, as our lobbyists are up there making their own laws and getting things passed, such as the 21st Century Cures Act. So remember, we had this federal brain initiative, and this was going to give all kinds of money to the research of the human brain so they could cure mental disorders. Well, there was something that came out just yesterday, 2 days ago, January 3rd, 2018. New brain mapping techniques reveals link between neuronal connectivity and your IQ. Well, how wonderful. Because remember, as we are being scanned through all of these new healthcare techniques that we are becoming guinea pigs for every time you go to the hospital. And I had like four different scans in a very short period of time. And I'm in that database somewhere. They're putting artificial intelligence, and NVIDIA, I mentioned the other day, has inked a partnership with like GE Healthcare or something like that to be able to scan these scans. Remember IBM Watson as well. They're looking at different CT and MRI scans, trying to be able to determine what means healthy and what means you're not, and to be able to determine how long you have to live just by your scans. Well, now they can determine your IQ. So all it's going to take is a simple scan to determine whether or not you are intellectually sufficient enough to be part of the future bloodlines of reproduction when sources and resources on this planet get scarce. That's where I look at this going in the end. According to a team of researchers at the University of Cambridge and the National Institute of Health, a novel and comparatively simple technique that maps the wiring of the brain has indicated a relationship between how well a connected person's brain regions are and their intelligence. The study, which was published in the journal Neurons, suggests that it is possible to build a map of the connectome, which are the connections in the brain, by examining conventional brain scans obtained by fMRI. The scientists for the past few years have been making a concerted effort to map the connectome and to understand its associations with human behaviors like intelligence and mental health disorders. And they also want to find a way to replicate that in the machine and potentially put it on the blockchain. Current study uses a conventional 3T MRI standard scanner, where 3T stands for the strength of the magnetic field, to compare the brains of 296 typically developing adolescent participants. And the findings were validated via a cohort study. That is another cohort study, like the All of Us program, of another 124 participants. And the conventional MRI scan provides a single image of the brain that enables the calculation of multiple structural features of the brain, and each region of the brain can be described using nearly 10 distinct characteristics. If two regions of the brain have similar profiles, the researchers describe them as having morphometric similarity and are assumed to be connected to a network. This assumption was verified using publicly available MRI data on a cohort of 31 juveniles, rhesus monkeys, in order to compare to a gold standard connectivity estimated in that species. The team built maps indicating how well connections of the major points called hubs are between different regions of the brain network, and they were utilized using morphometric similarity networks. The findings suggested an association between the connectivity in the morphometric similarity network in the brain regions related to higher order functions like problem solving, language, and intelligence. Well, phew! So they were able to find those regions that work for higher learning, IQ, and making connections. Well, what is coming out of all of this? You remember we talked a little bit about EEGs. There was a lot of technology in mapping the electrical activity in the brain and being able to distinguish what different activity translates into for movement and thoughts. There were some brain-computer interfaces coming that would allow you to control a computer with your thoughts. Good old Regina Duggan, formerly of DARPA, then went to Google, now and then moved over to Facebook. Now she's leaving, going to some unnamed yet place, was working on this neural interface that would allow you to interact with Facebook just by your thoughts, which I think is kind of amusing because I can't always hide my thoughts. Well, I ran across a story yesterday that caught my attention. I thought, well, this is quite a twist on this. Nissan. Next time you get a Nissan, you might have a new technology that's called B2V. Nissan's computer electronic show concept reads your brain waves to, quote-unquote, predict your moves, and it promises to benefit both manual and autonomous driving. Some things automakers show off are pretty straightforward, whether they're a new infotainment system or a part of an autonomous driving system. But arriving at CES 2018, which I think is this next week in Las Vegas, with a left field concept that involves hooking a car up to your brain. This is kind of hysterical, actually. Nissan calls its concept the B2V, short for Brain 2 Vehicle. Utilizing specialized equipment designed just for this purpose, the technology can analyze a person's brainwaves to directly affect how a vehicle functions. For example, if the brain signal that is going to move your body so the vehicle speeds up or turns, the B2V system can initiate that movement earlier, technically enhancing your reaction time. Nissan claims that the car can take action up to a half second earlier than rather than relying on the human movement alone. So you puny humans, you can't move fast enough. So if a vehicle were operating autonomously with the B2V tech, they could theoretically detect the human discomfort and adjust the vehicle's driving style. So they're going to give you that hypothetical brake pedal on the passenger seat and adjust the vehicle's driving style to put the passenger more at ease. It's going to give you an invisible steering wheel. So while this would be rather cumbersome and complicated things to bring to a hectic show floor at CES, that's the Consumer Electronics Show, Nissan will have a driving simulator on display that will show off some of the elements of the technology and will be on the ground next week. So check back here for more interesting auto-adjacent technologies like this. So I just had to share that because I thought it was interesting. So as we have brain-computer interfaces that are going to allow us to interface with our car, there was a story that came out, and I couldn't find a date on this document, and I hate when they do that, but I think, if I am not mistaken, this was probably back in 2014 we first started reading about these technologies that were financed by DARPA. And this comes out of the Weiss Institute of Biologically Inspired Engineering, as we were talking about putting mind files on the blockchain and digitizing human thoughts. What about digitizing human bodies and biology? And this is where it gets a little frightening. Weiss Institute of Biologically Inspired Engineering, human organs on a chip. Microchips lined in living human cells that could revolutionize drug development. And that would be for the pharmaceutical agencies and disease modeling, as well as your personalized medicine. Clinical studies take years to complete, and testing a single compound can cost more than $2 billion. So let's feel bad for the pharmaceutical industry. Meanwhile, innumerable animal lives are lost. So pull on your heartstrings and the process often fails to predict human responses because traditional animal models often do not accurately mimic human pathophysiology. For these reasons, there is a broad need for alternative ways to model human diseases in vitro in order to accelerate the development of new drugs and advanced personalized medicine. So don't worry about the ethics of this. We are just going to create humans on a chip. Weiss Institute researchers and a multidisciplinary team of collaborators, I love the way they put that, have engineered microchips that recapitulate the microarchitecture and living functions of human organs, including the lung, the intestine, the kidney, the skin, the bone marrow, and the blood-brain barrier. These microchips, called organs on a chip, offer a potential alternative to traditional animal testing. So we'll make all the greenies be quiet because we're just going to digitize humans. Shut up about it because there are no ethical issues here. Each individual organ on a chip is composed of a clear, flexible polymer about the size of a computer memory stick that contains hollow artificial vasculature, and mechanical forces can be applied to mimic the physical microenvironment of living organisms. Organs, including breathing motions in a lung, or peristasis-like deformations in the intestine. And because of these micro devices are translucent, they provide a, quote, literal window into the inner workings of human organs. With their ability to host and combine different cells and tissue types making up human organs, organs on a chip present an ideal microenvironment to mimic human-specific pathophysiologies and enable molecular and cellular scale analysis and identification of new therapeutic targets within an organ level context in vitro. They even allow recreating therapeutically relevant interfaces like the blood-brain barrier, ding, 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 which has been engineered from human stem cells. Now, remember, we found out they can engineer human stem cells to be any type of cell, including brain cells, from skin cells, using not only chemical cocktails to turn them into pluripotent stem cells, but also electromagnetism. So they can create human stem cells with novel differentiation methods to investigate drug pharmacokinetics and facilitate the discovery of new therapeutics. In another example, researchers are given the means to culture also a living microbiome for extended times in direct contact with living human intestinal cells to enable insight into how these microbes influence health and disease or the modeling of infections with clinically relevant viruses to identify viral strategies and vulnerabilities. Yeah, why would they do that? You know, I just look at this and I think DARPA was part of the development of this. So, of course, yes. Let's not only find out how to cure you, but how to kill you. It's always a double-edged sword. But to open up new possibilities to investigate how environmental factors like cigarette smoke can affect healthy tissue and physiology in individual patients has also shown in a smoking machine that precisely mimics human smoking behavior and its impact on the human lung airway functions. So what else have they been able to put on a chip? I'm starting to run out of time, and I still got like 8 stories here. Scientists have made a brain on a chip. And this was January 17th, 2017. This in vitro brain on a chip mimics the brain's connectivity, allowing researchers to examine different types of cells and connectivity between different brain regions. Now, remember, they also created little mini brain balls utilizing brain stem cells, and they let them grow in a petri dish. And then we read they also implanted tiny little mini brains into mice. And to their surprise, or maybe to their horror, they grew not only nervous connections, but vasculature to feed the little mini brain implanted inside of the rat or the mouse blood. Well, back to this brain on a chip. We've come a long way in our understanding of how the brain works, but the more we know about it, the more we realize we have much to learn. Artificial neural networks are complex, and the body's natural neural networks are even more so. However, we are making progress, and a team of researchers where? Oh, at Harvard University, you could have thunk it, may have just provided us with a better way to understand the brain. Using an in vitro brain on a chip that they designed to model the brain's connectivity, a team was able to extensively characterize the differences between neurons from different regions of the brain. The brain is so much more than individual neurons, and it is about different types of cells and the connectivity between different regions of the brain. And when modeling the brain, you need to recapitulate that connectivity because there are many different diseases that attack those different connections. They are affected, different regions are affected, and they can cause schizophrenia. And that's namely the oblongata, the hippocampus, and the prefrontal cortex. The team characterized each region in vitro in terms of the cell composition, protein expression, metabolism, and neural electrical activity. So I came across a story today, and this is what made me go back to those brains on a chip. This came out 2 days ago, January 3rd, 2018. A combination of neural and vascular models produces neurovascular tissue model. And this was developed by researchers in Keio University, Japan, and Harvard Medical School. They have constructed a 3D neurovascular tissue that combines neural and vascular models within a microfluidic system. Now, where have we read about microfluidic systems before? Well, that was in the body on a chip system. Researchers built a microfluidic chip, there you go, with compartments for neural cells and compartments for vascular cells, separated by a central portion filled with a specialized 3D biomaterial called a hydrogel. The hydrogel selected was a fibrin hydrogel hyaluronics mix, which the group found to crucially promote the growth of both neural and vascular cells. And I think this hydrogel was the same stuff that we read about a few weeks ago when they were talking about farming, literally farming brain cells and having them stay in that special pluripotent state. Maybe it was stem cells even, that special pluripotent state until they could turn them into what they needed for research, effectively replicating the 3D environment of the brain. This is advantageous over using plastic flasks, which fails to replicate the architecture of the physical properties of the brain and specific dimensions of the microfluidic device, which the researchers created, allowed for an interface between the vascular and the neural cells to develop between them so they can use them to study diseases and even drug screening.